Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. We present views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, and to help people find tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. Dr. Ingrid Mattson is professor of Islamic studies, founder of the Islamic Chaplaincy Program, and director of the McDonald Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. Born in Canada, she earned her BA in philosophy at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, and shortly thereafter lived in Pakistan, where she developed and implemented a midwife training program for Afghan refugee women. She earned her PhD in Islamic studies from the University of Chicago in 1999. Dr. Mattson has written articles exploring the relationship between Islamic law and society, as well as gender and leadership issues in contemporary Muslim communities. Her introduction to the Islamic sacred text, The Story of the Quran, Its History and Place in Muslim Societies, has been called, quote, a delicate balance of highly scholarly material and inviting anecdotes. In 2006, Dr. Mattson was elected president of the Islamic Society of North America. She previously served two terms as vice president. Welcome, Dr. Mattson.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you for being with us today. We appreciate you coming on and taking the time to share your significant knowledge, experience, and firsthand understanding and living of Islamic spirituality. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about your journey today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you again. Now, Ramadan is coming, isn't it?
That's right.
Can you share a little bit? Let's start at that beginning place today. We'll start with a celebration, a holiday. Can you share what the holiday is, its origins, its essence? And please feel free to take your time.
Right. Well, Ramadan is the name of the ninth month in the Islamic calendar, and it is the month that is designated for fasting. Fasting is done in a very disciplined fashion. It begins every day at dawn, which is, the first light of dawn, about an hour and a half or so before sunrise. And the fast lasts each day until sunset. So this is a complete fast from food and water. Even a glass of water, a sip of water is not allowed. And beyond that, it's also a time when we're supposed to fast from or restrain ourselves from aggressive action, anger. It's a time to learn great self-restraint. In terms of other rules, marital intimacy also is not allowed during those hours. If you have a bad habit like smoking, it's not allowed. So it really is, every day it's to practice for the month, each day of the month to build up that self-control and discipline. And of course, this has, a great deal of benefit to us in terms of our own ability in our life to respond positively and wisely to situations that confront us all the time, not to just react quickly. So there's a great benefit there. Of course, there's a social benefit that the practice of fasting is, it hits you. It hits you in your body, especially in when the day is long and hot. It is not easy to go such a long day without eating or drinking. And that feeling of fatigue, hunger, thirst is one that once you feel it in your body, I think you're going to be able to understand it much more deeply when you read about or hear about other people who are in this situation on a consistent basis, not voluntarily, but because of the situation into which they're born or they've fallen because of financial reasons, the economy, lack of development. So there's that further benefit on the collective level that should then motivate us to want to do something about this, to change that state for other people. It's easy for us to change it for ourselves by, at the end of the day or the end of Ramadan, to go back to our regular consumption patterns. But hopefully, having experienced this in a very conscious manner, we're not going to go back to our old ways, whether emotionally, spiritually, or even on a social and political level, that it's going to really change us at a deep level, so that we are motivated to act in a more just and thoughtful way in the world.
It sounds like a tremendous cleansing, not only from the food or drink sustenance, but also sort of from worldly pleasure and habits. Leading toward a spiritual shift, if that's pronounced. How does Ramadan end up then? How does it close?
Right. Well, let me just back up a little bit with a few more things about the month, and then we'll talk about how it's celebrated.
Sure.
One of the unique things about Ramadan in terms of American religious celebrations is that because the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar, and the lunar month is shorter, a 12-month lunar month is shorter than a solar year by about 11 days, it means that Ramadan is never the same time of the year. So every year, this month moves up 10 or 11 days. And this is why a few years ago, if people have Muslim friends, they might think, wait, I remember them fasting in November or December.
Right.
That we were, but now it's smack in the middle of summer. And we'll be beginning Tuesday night. The day begins at sunset, so we'll be beginning Tuesday night. And in the nights of Ramadan, people, the community gathers to recite the Quran every night. The Quran is traditionally divided into 30 parts, so that each night during that month, the community gathers and recites one of the parts. Now, that's often done as a community. It doesn't need to be. Many people can't make it in the evening to the mosque, so it's also perfectly acceptable to do it in your home individually or with family members, or even I used to gather a group of women in my home, and we would recite together, because many of them had small children. Many of us had small children, so we'd leave them sleeping upstairs and have a women's congregation together. So it's this beautiful time, where you have this flexibility to gather individually or collectively, but certainly that coming together to break the fast every evening is a blessed time. You're encouraged to invite, by Islamic tradition, you're encouraged to invite other people to share with you. And then, once you've gone through that, by the end of the month, then once Ramadan is over, then the next day is a celebration. And the word that's used is it's an Arabic word called Eid, E-I-D, and that it just simply means celebration. So it's the celebration of the breaking of the fast, Eid al-Fitr, and everyone gathers in the morning, a large congregational prayer. People who you haven't seen all year, everyone tries to attend Eid prayers, lots of the kids wear new clothes, and you get candy and sweets, and people Then, depending on the weather, there's very often people will go for community picnics. If it's snowing, as it does when it falls in the winter in the Northeast where I live,
mm-hmm.
there'll be, you know, probably some center or hall will be rented, and there'll be a big community party and celebration, and it's a lovely time. But one of the rules about that day is that you cannot celebrate until you, each person in the family, even a small child, must give a certain amount of money so that a person who doesn't have enough to eat can also celebrate that day. So each of us in the family must go and find someone who doesn't have enough or who's in need, and to give them so that they can also celebrate that day. And, you know, in America, it tends to be much more institutionalized. But I remember when I lived in Pakistan, you mentioned that I worked with Afghan refugees. In that traditional society, people tended just to go out on the street early in the morning or the night before and look and you know, look for those families around them who were in need and drop off money and food and gifts for them so that they could also enjoy the day as well.
Thank you very much for that answer. It's interesting, earlier you mentioned the lunar calendar, and in a similar way, Easter tends to move around a lot
yes.
from the calendar, and people say, oh, you know, it's in March, it's early this year, and not perhaps realizing why.
Right.
It's also scheduled on the lunar calendar. It's the first full moon after the spring equinox.
Mm.
And so that can move around in many ways as well.
You know, we're so we've become very dependent on clocks and calendars that are prepared for us. So
yes.
These things tend to slip our mind. But many in our community, many people in the community make it a practice of trying to sight the moon themselves, because the month begins with that first little crescent moon that's up for a few moments after the moon's gone dark. And you know, some families will go, people from the community will go. There are calendars available, but still many people try to look at it themselves. And there's something really awe-inspiring about that, and humbling about, you know, getting out in nature and being,
yes.
being, you know, letting yourself kind of let go of you always being in control of the time, but letting yourself, knowing that you're part of nature, and that you're waiting for that to unfold, even to begin this very important obligation.
That's a very interesting point you bring up about how so much is prepared for us. We can sort of lose sight of the origin, the sacred reason why things are the way they are, because it just pops up on our, you know, an Outlook or on our calendar on the wall, you know.
And, of course, there's a benefit for it. You know, I do advocate that we prepare calendars ahead of time, simply because, especially for Muslims in America, we're a very small minority, and it can be difficult for you know, children, school children, university students, and others to be able to get accommodations from work and time off for things. So that if the Islamic religious holidays are on sort of the general master calendars that are out there, it makes it easier for them, because some people are, you know, they're reluctant, they're inhibited, they're afraid that people are not going to accommodate them, or you know, in today's environment where many people have a negative view of Islam and Muslims. Some Muslims simply want to keep their head down, and so if these kind of things are accommodated for them in the public sphere, at least it makes it easier for them, and they can still privately have their own practices.
Now, of course, the topic of Islam is huge, and we'll be sort of scratching the surface today in this program. But I wanted to ask you from your perspective, perhaps a beginning place here for you, is what is at the center of life?
Right. For me, as a Muslim, the key principle is that all of creation is under the sovereignty of God, of the Creator. And that means that although human beings have a great responsibility over creation, and really, I mean, when we look at this earth, we see the power of human beings to truly destroy in a way that no matter how intelligent the dolphins are and other creatures, they can't destroy all of the environment for the rest of creation like we can. And at the same time, we can impact our environment positively, and we can impact, you know, make the lives of other creatures better if we choose to do so. So we have this huge responsibility, given the tools that we've been created with, our intelligence and our bodies and all of the other things that we have. Yet, we have to remember that all of this, in the end, is unfolding within a divine plan that we are not aware of. I mean, we have glimpses into our role. We have guidance about the limits that we should observe as we move about in this world. But there are going to be many, many things that we can't comprehend, and we have to have that confidence that that there is a unity to it all. That unity is the divine power, and that we should never give up. We should never be hopeless or disheartened when we feel, you know, that we're not making a big enough difference or we haven't figured it all out, because that's not our place. Our place isn't to figure it all out, but to do the best we can with the tools and the guidance that we've been given.
Thank you for that. Have you always been a Muslim?
Well, there's two ways to answer that.
That's the truest,
yes,
universal answer.
Right. Well, theologically, the word Islam means to submit to God. And Muslim theologians, Islamic theologians, feel that every human is born in that state naturally. So a kind of, you know, lowercase M Muslim, that everyone is born in that state of submission to God, that there's a natural receptivity to goodness and to guidance. But as a Muslim, a capital M Muslim, meaning belonging to a particular religious community, that is something that I embraced when I was a university student. I had been born into a primarily Catholic, Roman Catholic family, and had gone to Catholic schools, and had been quite observant. And I'm so grateful for much of what, especially the teachers and the Roman Catholic religious sisters gave me in terms of an example of sacrifice and service. You know, I feel that's still very much part of me, but I had a very, you know, conscious, I made a very conscious decision when I was 15 or 16 that I was not a Christian, at least in the sense that was taught me, because I disagreed with what I'd been taught, and I didn't feel that connection to it, although I still love the community. I didn't feel a connection with the teachings. So I was without religion, really very indifferent, in fact, to it for a number of years until I encountered Islam kind of unwittingly, not deliberately, when I was finishing my university. And to my surprise, within a year of that encounter, I myself had become a Muslim.
It's interesting to me that you, you know, came out of the Catholic background and had, you know, went on your journey in this sense. You have, a rather unique position in the community as in your role as president of the McDonald Center.
Well, I have two roles. I have my role that I'm just finishing up now as president of the Islamic Society of North America, and that is the largest umbrella organization for Muslims in North America. It's a role to which I was elected in 2006 and then re-elected. So that is my my role as a religious leader for Muslims in North America. But my paying job, my career is as a professor and now as director of the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Christian-Muslim Relations at Hartford Seminary. And this, as you say, it's interesting having come from, you know, a Catholic background, because my work at the McDonald Center is precisely improving Christian-Muslim relations and understanding. It's something that is very dear to me because I know these two communities well. I have family and friends and ties in both communities, and I don't see any need for there to be you know, hostility. There's so much beautiful that's shared by these two religions. Of course, there are things that are different.
Right.
But there's so much that we can do well together, and so much potential that needs to be tapped. So that's what I do here at Hartford Seminary.
In an article in the University of Chicago magazine, where you were interviewed, you commented on this, on your election, saying, and this is your quote, "So many women in the Muslim community have told you they feel hopeful because of your election. Many Muslim women are frustrated with the marginalization they feel in their local communities." And would you find that's a similarity between your Catholic hierarchy and in the Muslim hierarchy? There's a limitation that women are struggling with, and you've found, you know, in your role, and as you say, you have a great responsibility now to make sure you're not just a flash in the pan.
Right. Well, I think, in any large institution or movement or constituency that has gone through that didn't pop up in the last few years, but has been around for over 1,000 years or more, the issue of women's role in those communities is always going to be important. Not only Christian and Muslim women, but of course women throughout history have faced marginalization and oppression and patriarchy. You know, our faith is different than our religion, and our ability to fulfill the ideals of our religion is always going to be limited by who we are as human beings. Although throughout history there have been many people who've been visionary in different ways, and certainly in the Muslim community, women have had more opportunities for leadership than most people would think, and there have been female scholars. Still, the roles have been very limited in ways that have affected them in a very real way in the world, meaning that there have been characterizations of women, you know, filtered through a kind of religious ideology that impacted their ability to have the kind of autonomy that gives a human being dignity. the kind of empowerment that gives all human beings dignity. So that's something that I think, you know, we're living in an exciting time as women of faith because, at least for those of us who have, you know, have the opportunity to benefit from, you know, modern healthcare and educational opportunities, we really are in a very different position than the vast majority of women throughout history.
You mentioned that people aren't aware of the kind of opportunities that Muslim women have. Can we touch on that about misconceptions, I guess especially in the mainstream, regarding Islam and Muslim beliefs? What are the most perhaps most glaring misconceptions?
Well, I think what one of the problems, the main problem is that when you don't know a, when you have little knowledge of a community, you see everything that happens there, you know, as a sort of paradigmatic of that community. So, so when things happen in Muslim societies, we immediately assume that Islam is the cause. But in fact, Muslims are people who come from many different cultures, ethnicities, backgrounds. Some of them, you know, by the beginning of the 21st century, came out of 60, 70 years of communist rule. Others came from the experience of colonialism, etc. So we're talking about 1.5 billion people who bring in all sorts of history and interests, and as societies, nations, and as individuals. So not everything a Muslim does is because of Islam. And I think that's where some of the main misconceptions come in. For example, something like honor killing. There's no such thing called honor killing in Islam. If you murder someone, then that's murder. There's no, you know, it's not...
No righteous reason.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, this occurs in... Historically, it occurred for many, many centuries, even beyond that, around the Mediterranean, far before the rise of Islam. And among certain tribal people, the idea of honor, a code of honor, is very strong. And so you do find it in some places where Muslims live. But the reason isn't Islamic. So this is one of the important things that to understand, is that there's cultural practices that have nothing to do with Islam, even though Muslims are doing it. I think the other thing is, I would say that probably one of the main... It's quite interesting. You know, it's almost like a point of irritation, I find, to non-Muslims, is the fact that Muslim women, many Muslim women, observant Muslim women, cover their bodies, including, you know, many of them also include in that covering their hair. And it's people, many people make the assumption that this is, they're forced to do that. They don't want to do that. That covering is oppressive. And one of the things, you know, I understand part of the reason there's this misconception, because there are a few countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, where a very conservative dress code is imposed by the government and is enforced by the police. But at the same time, there are some very rigidly secular modern Muslim nation states where women are not allowed to dress that way. So in Turkey, observant Muslim women are not allowed to wear their headscarves in university. So the issue here really is not, you know, what they're wearing, it's whether the government has a right to involve itself in such a personal issue. And unfortunately, even France has gotten into this conversation. But you know, it's not surprising that that happened, because France, as a, it's this notion of a nation state that has a particular homogenous identity that is the common theme. You know, that our citizens all must behave this way, look this way, and I think we're lucky in America, really very lucky, that we don't have that idea. An American can look, can be black, white, you know, Native American, of Japanese descent. You know, we can look so different, and we can dress differently, and all of that is fine. You're still an American. There's not one prototype. If you deviate from it, somehow you seem odd.
Which is interesting, because in this society where we've chosen to separate church and state, there is a religious pluralism that's protected. So it's an interesting balance that we strike.
Absolutely, and it is that, you know, that's the really something that we can only hope to hold on to and should really fight to hold on to in this country, is the non-establishment of religion, because this gives the space for religious people to be honest about their own state, to take responsibility for their own communities. You know, I look sometimes at some other countries, and there are many, you'd be surprised how many countries there are in Europe, even Northern Europe, where there are official churches, you know, where the Anglican Church or the Eastern Church or, you know, or in the Middle East, a particular school of Islam is the official religious, the official doctrine of the state or the official church or school of the state.
Right.
And you know, I'm not going to say that those leaders are not good, but I don't see the kind of dynamic energy and creative thinking that I find in American religious leaders, who, you know, who don't have anyone but their own, but themselves and their own communities,
right?
You know, to keep them alive, and that, yeah, you know, it keeps you responsible and responsive.
That's fascinating. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break. We're about halfway through the show, but please stay with us. After the break, we will continue our exploration into Islamic spirituality with Dr. Ingrid Mattson, Professor of Islamic Studies and Director of the McDonald Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. This is from Hymns of the Sacred Quran by the Bektashi Brothers. Be right back. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're talking about Islamic spirituality with Dr. Ingrid Mattson, Professor of Islamic Studies at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. Hello there, Dr. Mattson.
Hi.
Are there different types of Muslims, different groups?
Oh, sure. There's a great diversity of Muslims.
Perhaps you can share a little bit,
sure,
touch on those.
First of all, there are two main, what we could call, sectarian divisions in Islam. And this is between, you know, many people have heard of the Sunnis and the Shiites because of what's happened in Iraq and elsewhere. The difference between Sunnis and Shiites is that Shiites have a follow a more explicit hierarchical religious authority, and that traces back to their belief that some of the religious authority that the Prophet Muhammad embodied was passed on through his descendants, known as the Imams. So the Shiites have this reverence for the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad and the Imams, and so this provides another source of guidance for them, spiritual and religious guidance, and it has an effect on their the hierarchy of their religious leadership. Sunni Islam, and Sunnis are the majority, about 85% in the world, have a more, you could say, open meritocracy in terms of religious leadership. So any person can speak authoritatively about the religion to the extent that anyone can. I mean, we always end any definitive statement about ethics or right and wrong with the statement, and God knows better. Mm. So there's a humility in that.
Yeah.
Anyone who strives to study the text, who prays to for God's guidance, who strives to really understand what God's will is in a situation to the best of their ability, can become a religious authority based on the recognition of other people. So it really depends on the recognition of others, whether you have authority or not. It's very fluid, and in some countries and in some times and eras, these things were more formalized than others. So that is really fluid. Now, other than these two main sectarian divisions, we have many people know about the Sufis of Islam.
Yeah.
Sufism is really the science of spirituality in Islam. And Sufis aren't separate from the rest of the Muslim community. Traditionally, almost any Muslim, whether Sunni or Shi'i, had a Sufi path or a discipline that they followed in addition to their theological and legal school. It was the discipline, the extra practices, guidance, and community that would keep them in touch with the core of what the law and the teachings were about. It's very unfortunate that with modernity, 19th century Enlightenment thinking from Europe came to Muslim countries with colonialism. And as the Europeans colonized Muslims, and devastated their nations, their livelihoods, their cultures, they also belittled and demeaned Muslim religious and spiritual practices as superstitious. And so many Muslims themselves kind of came on to embody this idea that, well, the reason we were colonized, the reason we couldn't defend ourselves is because we weren't scientific enough, we weren't rational enough. And there developed a kind of backlash against much of traditional Sufism and spirituality. Well, the 20th century modernity showed us that this notion that people are so rational and are determined, are always motivated, can be motivated by objective, rational beliefs, and that science is the answer to everything. I think we've learned from that that's not necessarily true.
So is there a sort of reclaiming then of the other mystical spiritual disciplines?
Very much so, and it's very heartening to see that. It's heartening to see that that an understanding of that this really was our this was at the heart of our faith throughout the centuries, This is something that Muslims have started to realize. As someone who, as part of my job, I train Muslim chaplains, and without Sufism, where would we have our spiritual psychology, our pastoral counseling? It all comes from this, these centuries and centuries of teachings and disciplines. So I'm happy to say, of course, like with any institution, there can be corruption. So of course, there were some people who were charlatans, and there were some people who took advantage of innocent or needy people. Mm. But that we don't throw out the wisdom with the people. Otherwise, we'd have nothing left. We'd have no government. We'd have no business. We wouldn't have any institutions.
I want to touch. You've said a couple of very strong phrases in the past minute or so. You used the phrase the heart of the faith and the core of the law.
Right.
Can we? I'd like to sort of get a little deeper into what is at the heart of the faith, the Islamic faith.
At the heart of it is the understanding that when we unpeel our layers, when we go back and back and try to separate what is our own interests, our own fears, our own anxieties from what God's will is, that this is the essence of the struggle of being a Muslim. As long as we're living, it's only a few great people, prophets and very holy people who are ever able to completely strip away all of those things to arrive at a state where they really do lose themselves in front of the awareness of the unity of God, the one true what is real. For most of us, all of what we're trying to do throughout our life is to push aside, ourselves, get ourselves out of the side so that we can be aware of that. I mean, there's a beautiful prophetic hadith that when the Prophet Muhammad said that when a servant of God continually tries to approach God with acts of reverence and devotion and mindfulness, that he can or she can arrive at a state that it is God's hand that with which he acts, and God's body, not God's body, but the feet with which he moves are completely in harmony with God's will. So this is the idea of trying to have yourself in that open state to be a witness to really what is going to unfold anyways and not get in the way. That is at the heart of being a Muslim, and it's why it is it's a struggle. It's always a struggle to do that and to unravel those many layers that we have.
And would you say that that would be true for all different Muslim groups, whether it's a person in Iran or in Afghanistan, that there's that same common understanding?
Oh, absolutely. And, all of us, all Muslims would understand this. How many of us, some of us are more fortunate than others in benefiting from teachers and communities that help us continue to be aware of this and keep this struggle. Others, are unfortunately so bogged down in some issues of conflict that are just plaguing their society, and then some of their leaders start to use the religious discourse in a political way or a politicized way that they start to deviate. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be political, or we shouldn't be aware of politics, we shouldn't be aware of the need to exercise power in a responsible way to help people. We don't check out as Muslims, we don't check out of the world.
Right.
But to not reduce religion to a political struggle, or reduce religion to even the issue of justice, because in the end, we're always going to be limited and what we can accomplish, and if we feel that we are the means to that, that our ultimate goal is to enforce justice, then we're going to end up being unjust, because we're going to take means that are not lawful, that are not ethical. So yes, this is clearly, you know, the heart of the faith, and you know, we're all struggling to realize that.
Tell us about your work in Christian-Muslim relations. How does that manifest for you in your role at the seminary and out in the world?
Well, it's very exciting. Here at Hartford Seminary, we're a graduate theological seminary, so I get to teach, and I teach Christians and Muslims from all over the world.
Teach them what?
We have, well, many things. We learn about, our students learn about each other's religions, so that there is no what we would call false witness towards the other. You know, a Muslim shouldn't say about Christians and Christianities what is not true.
Right.
And just as a Christian should not engage in false witness against Muslims saying Islam is this or that. So first we really have to understand each other, and that's by formal teaching and engaging in dialogue and discussion. And then learn some of the skills of peacemaking and dialogue so that we can become better at it and facilitate others to do it. And then look at the field of Christian-Muslim relations itself. So this summer, for example, I co-taught a course on the Common Word Initiative, which is a wonderful initiative. People could go to the website. I really encourage them to do so if they can, acommonword.com, which was an initiative launched a few years ago by a global coalition of Muslim scholars in response to Pope Benedict's Regensburg address, in which he said very unkind things about Islam and Muslims and the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslims revere. But the response was creative. It was non-confrontational. It was breaking away completely from this blame and counter-blame, and a hand reaching out to the Muslim world saying, Christians and Muslims together comprise more than half of the world's population. If we are not at peace with each other, the world will not be at peace. So come, let's come together on a common word, two fundamental principles of our faith, which we agree upon, love of God and love of neighbor. And if we simply cooperate on those two things and implement them, then we can make such an impact in the world.
Did you just say love of God and love of neighbor?
That's it. Those are the two.
Didn't someone else say that too?
Well, that's it. This is why it's from our, I mean, and the doctrine gives the proof text from both, you know, Christianity and Islam, saying, you know, let's forget about all this other stuff. There's
right.
things that we need to do. And it's
become a beautiful, awesome.
Yeah, it's a beautiful worldwide movement. I mean, That document and that movement has spawned so many wonderful initiatives from, you know, Christian-Muslim cooperative groups, social justice groups at local community levels, to places like the Southern Philippines, where I have a friend, a leader named Amina Rasul, who works in reconciling Christians and Muslims in the Southern Philippines.
Yes.
And she's used this initiative to bring imams and ministers and priests from all over there, and also people who have been militants, bring them together to try to get at the root of any religious justification for violence and conflict.
Well, that's very, you know, interesting that the... you know, when asked what the greatest commandments are, that's what you know, Jesus said in response: that love God and love your neighbor.
That's right.
And the whole rest of the law hangs on those two things.
But we get hung up on many other things. Yeah.
You know, that's fascinating. So, where then, you know, once people have gone through the program and they've taken the courses and done the dialogue, do they go back then to their own communities and carry it on? How does it get lived out, the relations then?
Right. So we have people in, we have ministers and imams and chaplains and others in America who go back to their congregations and do things at that level, to reach out to their communities, to be centers of reconciliation and understanding locally. Then we have our students who come through our International Peacemakers program and others internationally who take what they've learned and go back to areas of conflict and act as, again, as instruments of peace and understanding. It's very satisfying to see what they've done. Of course, you know, there's a lot. As you know, Carol, it's hard to get the good news out. I mean, if you just follow the mainstream news, you would think
yes.
that Christians and Muslims are simply
I know.
In conflict all the time. But it's not the reality. They're trouble. They're, you know, troublemakers out there for sure.
Well, and the whole angle, as you have mentioned before, of news coverage, for example, you said in another article, yes, a lot of this is cultural misunderstanding when the news says that, you know, there was a Muslim attack on police in Afghanistan today.
Right.
And the entire country is Muslim, so are the police.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not a Muslim issue.
Right.
There's something cultural going on there that's, of course, very apparently skewed, you know, in the mainstream. And you're mentioning the chaplaincy program. Let's chat about that for a moment. Are you referring to that would be chaplains in hospitals or in other roles in the community?
Right. So we have, at Hartford Seminary, about 10 years ago, we founded the first program in the United States for Muslim chaplains. There have been Muslim chaplains in different institutions for some time, but they have not had the opportunity to be specifically trained for this calling. And so we have a graduate program for chaplains and they are going to colleges, universities, hospitals, prisons, and the military. So it's just a fantastic program. It's very satisfying because we have people who've been out in the field doing it who are coming back now and getting their credentials and some more support. But we also have many young people who are coming directly out of their undergraduate, you know, college degree, coming into this field. And it's open for men and women. So we have Muslim women chaplains who are serving the community as well as men, and they're really making a very big impact on society.
Hmm. Ingrid, as we come toward the end of this program, you are a person on a journey traveling between communities and yet helping both. Is there one component in your faith that stands out, that has deeply affected or awakened your own understanding and living of life?
I would say it's gratitude. I am aware that that I am simply the beneficiary of other people's great work, sacrifice, effort. Of course, ultimately to God. For giving me life and the opportunity to witness all that's happening in front of me. But I'm constantly in a state of gratitude. You know, anything I've been able to do, it's because I've been, the ground has been laid by others. The example has been set. Just today, as I was walking out in the garden, I was thinking of my great aunt, who was my godmother when I was young, and the example that she set for me. She was a widow and used to work very hard to take care of so many things. And I was dragging some heavy branch somewhere. I was thinking, okay, Aunt Mary. You know, whether it's my scholarship or religious leadership. You know, thinking of all those great role models throughout history, I feel so grateful to be able to have to to know about them and to be able to have some opportunity to try to embody a little bit their example and principles and values.
If people in the audience want to learn more about your work or the Islamic faith, you mentioned acommonword.com before, but can you tell us other places where people can learn more?
Sure. Well, they can come to the Hartford Seminary website. We have some resources there, and that is hartsem.edu, hartsem.edu.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also urge them to come to the website of the Islamic Society of North America, which is isna.net, isna.net.
And if anyone wanted to get hold of your book or books?
My book is available through online booksellers or in some stores. You know, you could get it through wherever you normally buy your books. It's published by
online at Amazon.
Anyone in particular?
Thank you.
By Blackwell Wiley, 2007.
Very good. Thank you so much.
All right. It's been great speaking with you, Carol.
Thank you. So, thank you very much, Dr. Mattson. It has been very interesting. It's just the beginning. Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
All right. I'd be delighted to do that.
I would, too. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on the Godspeed Institute on the Progressive Radio Network. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again or send it to someone, simply go to progressiveradionetwork.com and click on the archive link. We hope you have enjoyed the show today and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, I'm Carol Hallenbeck. Thank you for joining us today, and we will wish you Godspeed on your journey as we talk again soon.